This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes, between the lines, and into the valleys, in this case, of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It is episode 245 with Samuel Harvey. He is an Aspen, Colorado-based artist and gallerist, and I had the opportunity to meet Sam at the United States Artists Assembly this past March in Chicago. It was my first time there. They had me out. Want to thank United States Artists very much again for having me and all the folks there and at Cultural Council. Sam was one of the people that I got to hang out with the most, I would say. And something that I was particularly intrigued by with Sam is that he asked a lot of questions, like more, as many as more than I asked, which was really impressive. So if only you could hear the things that he asked me, that's for another time. In any case, he is indeed, as I said, an artist and owns the Harvey Preston Gallery in Aspen, Colorado. Yes, this is our first Aspen guest, and you will find Sam to be very open, very optimistic, has a very refreshing perspective. And in addition to all that, he's going to offer you, and he offered me as well, an invitation to visit him. So stick around towards the latter part of this conversation to hear that offer. The website for this podcast is, as you probably know, theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Sam and his work and his gallery, and hopefully some nice contextual shots of the Valley of Aspen, Colorado. And if you go now to the episode index page of the website, you will see that a good portion of them are now linked to their respective web pages. So if you want to look into a particular episode going all the way back into the, well into the 100s, you can check those out. Thanks, courtesy to producer Sarah Suarez. So I think you're going to really enjoy this. On the back end today, I have some great old news, aka Weiss links, to catch you up on, because indeed this is a tight hour or less episode or conversation. So definitely stick around for those. In the meantime, as we join the conversation, Sam is talking about what first led him to Aspen and then eventually how it became his home. Enjoy. I will talk to you more on the back end.
As an undergrad, I had gone to the Anderson Ranch Art Center because a professor was teaching there, and he suggested that a few of us come out and check it out because it was the summer in between semesters and we weren't really doing anything. And he said, get yourselves out here to Aspen, Colorado and find the Anderson Ranch.
Right.
So we did that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you had spent time there through the Anderson Ranch. And then when you were done with Boulder and Vail and needed more of an art community that Aspen had, what was it like getting there? It's not a cheap place to live, and it probably hasn't been for a long time. Am I right?
You're absolutely correct. But I spent, in the beginning, my early years, I spent most of my time at the Anderson Ranch. And so there was housing available there, and I was the assistant to the director of the ceramics department. So I had a job, and I had a place to be, and a place to work. So that made all of that transition easy, which was years ago from my life now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now I have a gallery in Aspen, and I am not as involved in the Anderson Ranch as I used to be,
mm-hmm.
because I have my own thing going and my own project and the work I do with other artists.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm sorry if this sounds like the same thing, but I'm continuing to kind of hammer the same question, which is how was it getting settled then? I mean, so eventually, as you alluded to, and one of the reasons I'm particularly interested to talk to you is because you're doing the dual situation of being an artist and having a gallery, which is pretty uncommon.
Yeah.
I mean, how I mean, to rent a space in Aspen, I imagine, is pretty challenging. I mean, so how does one work their way into such a situation?
I wish I could make it really easy, but it's not. It's like, it's one of those things where one situation leads to another situation, and you kind of fall into this thing that has grown pretty much under your feet, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, so one thing led to another. I mean, for years, I worked at the Anderson Ranch. Then I left that after about 9 years. Then I went to graduate school, right, Alfred University, and then I moved back to the Valley, and I worked part-time as an art installer for the Aspen Art Museum and some private clients, and I rented a studio in a kind of industrial area, and my business partner and I at the time found a location that wasn't being used, and the developers approached us to open a gallery in the space, and that's kind of how it started.
That sounds like a real turning point right there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It was a huge turning point. So we were at the base of Highlands Ski Area for about 7 years and built up an audience for our project, which was the gallery. And we knew it would work because my business partner at the time, Allegheny Meadows, who's still one of my best friends, and I absolutely love him, he was also an assistant at the Anderson Ranch. And he also had his list of clients. So between his list and my list, we knew we had people who wanted to support ceramics.
Right. Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned, I mean, it would have come up very soon, if not in a little bit more time than that, ceramics. And I was looking at your gallery website, and of course your own work is ceramics. So to what extent is Aspen, or even Colorado for that matter, wider than Aspen, a real hub of ceramic art makers?
There's the University of Colorado at Boulder. Which has a huge history of having great ceramic instruction and instructors. Mm-hmm. Betty Woodman taught in that program for about 27 years. And then in the Fort Collins area was Richard DeVore, who ran that program for many years. And then here in the Valley, there was Doug Casebeer. But before him, there was Paul Soldner, who has a Los Angeles connection with Peter Volkas and Otis Institute. So there's a lot of overlapping histories.
Right, right. I think I want to get more into ceramics, but I think I want to continue with the arc of your business. So you mentioned your first partner. So he was a fellow ceramic maker that you were working with?
Yeah, and he still works as an artist, and he's still making work. He's still in the Valley, and the reason we're not business partners anymore is because of the amount of time it takes to run your own studio, making your work, and run a gallery. So he just felt like there wasn't enough time to do both properly, and his commute was longer than mine. He had like a 40-minute commute each way. So mine is only 20, and I seem to be able to manage getting up early and working in the studio, then working in the gallery, and then going home and getting some things paid attention to before heading to bed.
Right. Yeah. Can you talk about? I know this is kind of getting into the weeds, but I hope people, you and people listening, will understand eventually why. But where is it that you describe living 20 minutes away from your studio, and where is your studio?
So I live up Castle Creek Valley, up Castle Creek Road, about 10 minutes, oh no, I'm sorry, about 9 miles from Aspen. It's beautiful, absolutely stunning valley on the Castle Creek River, on 10 acres of property that unfortunately I don't own, but I am able to rent a building on some friends' property. And It's a three-bay car garage below the apartment. So all three bays are currently my my studio.
Okay.
That's yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say that's your studio you just described.
Yeah, yeah. My studio is a happy disaster. Mm. I have tons of projects happening all at once, from things that are ceramic oriented to things that have absolutely nothing to do with ceramics, because I make works on paper. So I make paintings and I use a lot of other materials as well. So
and you described that the studio that you just described is 9 miles from Aspen proper, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is Aspen proper where you live, where your home is?
No. I live above my studio.
Oh, okay, got it. So the apartment is yours above, and then the studio is below.
Right.
And
so
then the gallery is in Aspen proper.
Correct.
And that's 20 minutes away, as you said earlier.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty easy.
Yeah.
So I can and what I love having my studio close to where I live, because I can literally have an idea and go downstairs in my pajamas and take care of it and see where it goes or where it's not going to go.
Right.
So it's just really convenient.
I'm going to insist, because you just created quite an image, I'm going to insist on one of the images that you eventually provide be you at 3 a.m. in your pajamas working in your studio.
That is not going to happen. I'll tell you that now.
Thank you for the warning.
See, that's the intimacy of working in a space where no one gets to see you.
Right.
Because you don't have to worry about being judged. You don't care. All you're thinking about is going downstairs and getting something done.
Right.
So, and I love that.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of artists do. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I'm one of those artists that's not. I mean. While I can share a studio with other artists, I really love being in the space of thinking about what it is that I'm working on and not having a whole lot of distractions.
Yeah, right. And it's pretty quiet out there, I imagine.
Right. Yeah. It's incredibly quiet.
Right, that's great. So one of the points of, or the larger point of context that I wanted to eventually get to and asking all these details, which maybe listeners are going, why are you getting so in the weeds about this, is that when you and I first met, I don't know if you remember this, one of the anecdotes that I shared with you from a book that I had read several years ago, it's one of there are two Robert Franks that both write about the economy, and I believe it's the Robert Frank without the initial used, and he wrote a couple of books. One of them was called Richistan. It might have been that one. It might have been another one. But in any case, there's this unforgettable image that he, or picture that he paints of the main road into and out of Aspen being clogged with people going into Aspen, who are all of the people who can't afford to live in Aspen but go to work in Aspen. So that's why I wanted to sort of get a sense of where you work, where you work in your and live and so on. Do you want to talk about what it's been like over the years that you've lived there as far as that situation?
It's a complicated thing, right? Because it happens in New York, it happens in San Francisco, it happens in L.A., right?
Sure.
You want to be in the city where the action is, but you can't afford to live there. Right. In the beginning, lots of people can afford to live in let's say, Soho or San Francisco. But then, everybody wants to be where the cool kids are and they have more money, which raises the prices, which means that the cool kids can't stay there. And then when they get there, these new people, they want to have everything quiet by 10 o'clock. So they've essentially killed why they wanted to be there in the first place. So I don't know where that tangent's going, but anyway.
It sounded like you described something more particular to Aspen than to New York or San Francisco, because obviously New York, there's very few places where it gets quiet at 10 o'clock except for the suburbs, and San Francisco kind of similar. But one of the details, if you indulge me a little bit further, is when I think of Aspen, I wonder if there are even that many rental, like apartment type situations to begin with. Is it not more houses that?
Oh, no, no. So Aspen, and again, we probably don't want to get into the weeds about this, but Aspen has an affordable housing program.
Oh.
So that, so the teachers and the people who run the hospital and other you know, necessities of running a city can afford to stay here, right? So there's a huge affordable housing program that's built in because there's limited space.
Yeah,
you know, it is a valley, so at a certain point, there's nowhere to build.
Right, right.
Anyway, so that helps people to be able to live here.
A few people, I would imagine.
Quite a lot, actually.
Mm.
Because the second homeowners are also not here year round.
Right.
Right. They kind of helicopter in. They do their Aspen thing, and then they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they, you know, again, it's an incredibly beautiful place. They meet their friends here. They go out to dinner. They buy art. They participate in cultural exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
Blah 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 blah.
Right.
And then they're off to the Hamptons or back to New York or back to L.A. or back to, you know, Greece or wherever. So there are many, what we say here is that there are many kinds of Aspen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There is the 1% that you never see, and they never see you. And they have their Aspen and you have your Aspen. So it's really interesting that way.
Well, are not some of the 1%, or maybe better, more specifically put, the 0.01%, some of your clients for your gallery?
Hopefully. I try to get their attention.
Right.
But then again, I'm not an A-list gallery, right? So, Aspen does have an A-list gallery, and there again is a different kind of strata, right? So there are collectors who need the stamp of an A-list gallery on their collection.
Right.
So they have advisors and, you know, it's a structured system for acceptance.
How would you characterize your clients then?
My clients, first of all, you know, very few ceramics have a resale value. So you have to buy it because you really love it, and I represent people who make really, really great work, and who are really fantastic artists, and they really have their stuff together. But if you're coming at it from an investment perspective, this may not be your venue, right? So those people are not going to look at ceramics, which is fine. I mean, there are other, and in some ways, the art world was wrecked in the late 90s, late 80s, early 90s by the notion of art as an investment portfolio. Because that's not something you can guarantee. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't say if you buy this sculpture today, in 5 years you'll be able to get twice your money back. And some, they're collectors or people who are in the art world who try to predict the next hot artist.
Sure.
So they can say, oh my God, I bought their work early.
Yeah.
And I can't guarantee that. And you know, I've had clients who've asked me, like, oh, is this going to be more expensive in, you know, a few years? That's like, I can't make that promise to you, and I'm not, because I'm not in that business.
So you're a straight talking gallerist, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not going to, yeah, I believe that you come to my gallery because I have beautiful objects, and I have objects that are super smart and very relevant. And that's my client list, and those are the people I want to talk to, because they love it, not because they're looking for, I don't know, you know, the next hot object that they can brag about at a cocktail party.
Right. But so, more specifically, because it's still kind of a vague picture of who your clients are, other than that they love ceramics and that they're not speculative investors when it comes to art. But, I mean, let's frame this, let's contextualize this for a second, because as you described when we spoke recently in advance of this recording, you are mounting a show that's coming up that is going to coincide with sort of the early phase of the season, which is going to, you know, breeze through the valley over the next month or couple months or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Are your clients do they tend to be made up of people that are in town, you know, for that high season, or is it a mix of them and also people who are there year round?
Yes, both.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely both.
Right.
I mean, because again, some second home owners will come in, they'll come at the peak of summer season and peak of winter season,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
To hang out with their friends and do their thing.
Right.
But I like to, I like to think that my roster of artists appeal to locals as well as, you know, the one percenters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I curate shows based on, it's almost selfish because I really want to see the ideas that an artist is bringing to the table, you know, with some respect to the fact that I want these pieces to live in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to sell them, and I want them to, you know, to have legs and travel.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not specifically curating shows because, you know, it's all about the sale.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I'm fortunate in that, you know, when my business partner, Allegheny, and I got this space, we negotiated a really decent rent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could not negotiate that rent now. I mean, Aspen's retail space is pretty up there. It's L.A., it's New York, it's the same, you know, $8,000 to $40,000 a month.
Wow.
Depending on the space.
Are you in locked in for a long lease or?
No, the other lucky thing is that it's kind of lucky and unlucky in that I'm in a building that the owner wants to tear down and put up something much more like Rodeo Drive, right? And he's been trying to do this for 4 years, so I've been able to maintain the same rent that we've had for going on 6 or 7 years.
Mm.
So he hasn't raised the rent because he hasn't done anything to, like, improve the building.
What is his strategy? Is his strategy to... How does he plan on getting you guys out of there?
Well, when he gets all of his permits, which I don't know if he has or not, but there are about 10 tenants in this building.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll all have to leave, and he'll scrape it, right?
And is your perspective, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it, or are you thinking about other options yet?
Well, I'm always thinking about other options, like working with other galleries, working with other friends
mm-hmm.
who have galleries,
mm-hmm.
And seeing if, you know, I could do a smaller program. So I am always thinking about other options, but there's no way in hell I can afford current Aspen rents.
Sure.
Yeah, on my own, forget it, man. I mean, and again, this is ceramics. We're not talking like investment Warhols or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So,
well, you're talking about a precariousness that, you know, a lot of us are dealing with in one way or another. You know, I'm in both apartment and studio precariousness, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure a lot of people in other art capitals or what have you are in similar situations. So, but it sounds like, as you described kind of the beginning of our conversation in terms of the sort of organic nature of the way that you settled in, you know, to the community and the gallery and so on, that something will emerge, you know, should this space at some point get scrapped, as you said.
Right, right. And the other thing is, I'm an artist. So,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
As an artist, you learn how to make, you know, lemonade out of lemons.
Mm-hmm.
It is a creative process of figuring out what is the next thing to be done.
Right. Yeah, and
so I'm not terribly worried. It's like,
well, good for you.
Yeah,
yeah
I, 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 like Allegheny and I have had a great, great, great run with our gallery, and we've had amazing shows and helped a number of artists really get their work out there. But again, I could focus on my own studio practice. I could
your own what?
My own studio work.
Right. Thank you.
I apologize.
Thank you.
Well, you have to explain this to people now that you brought it up.
No, I already have, believe me, in prior episodes I have. here's a great segue, which I was going to bring up earlier anyway, to talk about the dual role of being a gallerist and an artist, and how, on one hand, you were talking quite a bit earlier about embracing, the passion that you have for wanting to get your artist's work into collectors' hands and homes, mm-hmm. and so on. How do you navigate, the sort of selflessness of that alongside your own work and trying to promote that side of things?
Go a little bit deeper with that.
Yeah, well, so if you want me to maybe a more specific question, is it ever hard for you to be, the constant advocate for these artists that you represent and put your own identity as an artist yourself into the background?
Nope, not at all.
Why not?
I'm pretty secure in my in what I do as an artist, mm-hmm. and what it does for me. So
what
I
does it do for you?
I'm not. You mean working in a studio and making work?
Well, you just said what it does for me. So what did you mean?
Yeah. So being in my studio and doing what I do just brings me like endless joy. So I don't have to compare myself to anyone else,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
I there's no need to compare.
Are you one of those artists who, I saw a video about this many, many years ago, and there was one artist in particular who I'm not going to name, who is really the epitome of this, but the flow artist, like you go into the studio and then you forget what time it is and 8 hours have gone by. Are you one of those types of artists?
Oh my God, I hate to say it, but I'm one of those people.
I hate you.
That's fine. I'm still going to do what I'm going to do. Regardless.
I know. Right. But will you really work for several hours in a row and kind of not realize where the time has gone?
Right.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean what you do is going to be worth anything.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are no guarantees here, people.
Well, how this is? I know this is getting into the weeds, people. Speaking of people again, but when you start to evaluate, is that like maybe as does that happen as soon as you kind of stop working and kind of come out of that flow period, or is it usually unfold over a course of days and even weeks?
Oh, it unfolds over time.
Yeah,
but I really want to go back to what you were alluding to with regards to how I feel about my work,
mm-hmm.
when I'm representing other artists.
Right.
And so for me, I guess I don't, there's no sense of competition or worry,
mm-hmm.
or,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Oh, like, absolutely. No, it makes complete sense. I think the reason that I've been asking some of these questions is that I'm pretty much on the other end of the spectrum from you.
I'm really happy for my friends whose work hit it big or they
right.
get a lot of attention.
Right.
And I want that to happen for them and I want it to happen for myself,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not, if they're getting more attention than I am, that's not a worry for me. It's like, good for them, right?
Yeah.
Like, you have to support your friends and you can't be like, oh, woe is me. It's like, we've all made these choices.
Sure.
And I mean, the gaze of the art world is always looking for the next shiny object, right? And sometimes that object or that person has a long career and sometimes they're flash in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
And the art world is, it can be a really dangerous place.
Yeah.
I mean, for a lot of people, because I've had friends whose career has grown, and all of a sudden they're selling work that's, you know, $50,000, $20,000, et cetera, et cetera. And then the rug gets pulled out from under them,
mm-hmm.
and no one's buying their work. And now what do you do? You know, you were selling work for $20,000, and now you're selling nothing. And then what happens to your career?
Yeah.
Do you get a teaching job? Do you go to IT? What happens to you? So it's very seductive to be at the peak of the art world, but it could also trip you up if you don't know what the hell you're doing.
I'm imagining that the example or the case that you just described has happened with some of the artists you represented, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You're at a high price, and then
yeah.
all of a sudden it's like, holy shit, you're not selling anything.
And so can you describe what happened with one of them without mentioning any names? You know, like, what did so-and-so do when that happened to them?
They had to get a job. Like, you know, they had to, you know, get an extra job to pay for the thing that they'd built.
And were they able to make enough money to get by after having been making a lot more, presumably?
It's a struggle. They changed careers.
Mm-hmm,
they became a chef.
Okay, interesting. Maybe you should recommend that person for the show.
yeah, but it's like they rerouted their creativity,
right?
So the art world is just so interesting, and there's so many tiers to it, right? And it's not one monolithic thing.
Sure, absolutely. You probably haven't had a chance to listen yet, but what I've taken to saying over the last half year maybe or so at the beginning of the show is it's a podcast about the contemporary art worlds with an S, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what is, to what extent do you, with your own work, depend on being a percentage of your income?
A very small.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I make a lot of work for that I actually give way to auctions to fundraise for,
mm-hmm.
you know, art centers and other venues.
Right.
And
Yeah.
So it's a small percent.
And then meanwhile, if you don't mind my asking, when it comes to your gallery, is it really go time, you know, in those two high seasons, in the winter and the summer, as far as a certain sales points that you need to make?
You know, again, I don't terribly worry about those things because they happen.
Right.
They happen organically in,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that I have a number of, I don't know how to explain this other than that then the work finds an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's great.
And I keep my costs really manageable so I don't have to freak out.
Right.
And I seem to always manage to pay my artist and pay my bills.
That's
and
great.
I'm one of those people that pays the artist first and then the bills and then myself.
Right. That's very thoughtful of you.
So
you're kind of the anti-Doug Christmas.
Well, the other thing is the art world can be a small place, right?
Sure.
And I have lots of friends in the art world, and I wouldn't want to become one of those people that has a bad reputation of not paying their artists,
yeah.
which is just completely unconscionable. Or you hold on to people's money to do other projects.
Sure.
So I just make it a point of paying people as soon as I can pay them. Because they have bills and needs and just like everybody else.
Are you running the gallery alone or do you have another partner now?
I'm running it alone now. I have two people that are gonna help me in terms of like gallery sitting and running the gallery. But right now it's me. And I'm again looking for good, competent help. And you know if you're in a larger city, you have many more options.
Right.
To choose from, like people who are doing gallery studies or whatever, but in Aspen you don't really have that many people to choose from in terms of employable
mm-hmm.
bodies.
So we could call this a job ad for people in the Aspen
Absolutely.
Vicinity.
Anybody out there who...
so who's
just looking for a job.
Yeah. Who's the Preston, then, in Harvey Preston?
That's my middle name.
Oh, okay. I was thinking that might be the case. Yeah. You were working with the partner, and then you separated.
Right.
So
it was first. It was a Harvey Meadows Gallery. So it was Samuel Harvey and Allegheny Meadows.
Right.
Now it's Harvey Preston, which is just me.
Got it. You know, one thing that I did want to respond to is when you said. You don't worry when I asked you about the sales you needed to make, and you said, "I don't worry too much about it; it happens organically." I mean, that's great, and Godspeed, and I hope that continues to be the case as long as the gallery, you know, exists in this form. But we had just been talking about these artists who experience great downturns. You know, maybe by implication, you're describing a world in which with artists. Things are much more flighty than a gallery, especially one that I guess has built up from the ground very carefully and steadily.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a couple of things here, right? So there's the seduction of wealth and fame, which can really trip some people up without them thinking about how longevity. Right, they're thinking about the tension of the moment.
Yeah,
but the moment doesn't last, right? So you have to get good at orchestrating your career, and not let some gallerist or the system pull you when you're not ready to be pulled.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Or if it is your moment, then you have to get good at stocking away that cash. That cash flow somehow, so that you can go back to it.
Mm-hmm.
So the people that I guess I represent in my gallery, they're pretty much all stable. In what they do as artists and their careers, and I guess I don't know how to further explain that, but. I don't know.
Well, I think I would clarify or sort of continue the question by asking you to clarify. You were describing the gallery in terms of how your artists are doing, but there's a whole other side of the gallery, which is how you're doing, you know, because it's not the artists alone that are doing your work for you. I mean, you are having to what extent? Because one thing that we should say as we're talking about the gallery that you're running that I think is noteworthy is that it says on your website, and you mentioned this when we spoke last time, that your gallery is open every day, right?
Seven days a week.
That's really unusual. Is that something that goes along with being a ceramics gallery, or is that an Aspen thing, or what's that about?
It's an Aspen thing because we only have short seasons, right? So the season is just about to begin.
Right.
Food and wine, which is kind of like the big start of the season. Food and wine is next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So then it goes the rest of June, July, August, September. Then in September, the leaves start to change. So then you have leaf peepers, and that goes on until like the middle of October, and the season's over, right? And then you don't... And so the town kind of empties out. It's like the local stay, of which I am a local. So we all stay, and then the tourists go. And it gets super quiet, and it doesn't pick up again until, like, end of around the beginning of December.
Okay. Do you shut the gallery down in October, November?
Yeah. So I work in my studio, or I go traveling, or I go visit friends. For the recent off season, which is at the end of April, I went to visit Allegheny, who was teaching in Italy.
Mm.
So I spent 10 days in Italy with him in Cortona, and then we went to Venice. And then he and I went to visit Betty Woodman's studio, who was a professor of mine, and she became a great friend of the galleries.
Mm-hmm.
and she passed away last spring. So he and I went to pay homage to Betty and George, her husband, and so we went to their studios, which was phenomenal.
Which is where?
It's outside of Florence. Mm. So we went to visit her studio. Then I taught a workshop in Wyoming for a weekend, and then I taught a workshop in a ceramic workshop in Mexico for a week. So, see, that's the other thing I guess I should mention is that I occasionally teach workshops and sell my work and show other people's work that I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also, I mean, I'm one of those people that has loved art since I was like four,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It works out. It seems to work out somehow.
That's great. I'm sure you're making a lot of artists listening envious.
Well, I want them to be friends, so
okay.
They should come and visit. We should hang out. They should, you know, if they don't believe in what I'm doing, they should, you know, question me on it, and I'm willing to talk. I mean, I did my undergraduate at the Kansas City Art Institute. I did my master's at Alfred University. I did a semester at CCAC, which was called the California College of the Arts, and I did a semester with Betty Whitman in Boulder as a grad student. So I've had a lot of education in the art world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that you memorably said in your talk where we met in Chicago at the U.S. Artists Assembly is that for anybody who's coming through Aspen, they should come see you. So are you inviting all my listeners the same?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Come hang out with me. Come check out the back room. Let's talk about artwork. Let's talk about what you like and what you hate.
Right.
I'm good with any of that.
I love it. Well, see, that's something, you know, I hate to be like the bad guy in this exchange, but I rarely encounter that kind of openness in my travels in the art world. And I've traveled the art world to a great extent as well in different ways than you. But I really appreciate it. I don't want to, you know, stamp down the appreciation that I have of your openness. I wish there was more of it, is all I'm saying.
I think, you know, I think there are always options. Let's rephrase this. For some people, there are not always options. I like to think for myself, there are always other options.
Mm-hmm.
Even when it's a shitstorm,
mm-hmm,
there are other options.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I don't, you know, as a gallerist, I don't always get to pay myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are months when I have no freaking money and I'm thinking, shit, I got to buy some light bulbs, right? So, and then a sale happens. So,
wow.
You know, again, I'm not like David Zwirner or any of those other people. And, you know, God bless them. They're doing a great thing and I appreciate what they do, but that's not what I do.
I'm so glad you said that because that was not an image that I had in my mind that, you know, that things got so tight. Does that happen from time to time, like once a year or every couple of years or something, would you say?
Oh, once again, it's unpredictable.
Right.
Right? But again, I try to make sure, I don't think there's one artist that I've never not paid.
Right.
Or that we have never not paid.
Sure.
And they will get paid before I do, even if I have to take out a loan.
Mm-hmm.
But the other aspect of this business is if it gets to a point where I can't afford to do it, I will close it in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to go, you know, deep into debt for this project, which I love.
Sure.
I mean, there is a practicality that I have to be aware of.
You do a 50-50 split, is that right, with your artists?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, and then on resales, I do like, 30 to 27%. So, yeah.
What does a resale look like?
Resale is like you are reselling an artwork for a client,
mm-hmm,
in your gallery.
Oh, okay. Right.
Right.
But the reason I ask is because earlier on you had mentioned how with ceramics there isn't the kind of auction reliability of other forms. So I wonder if that.
Not always, but there's some artists who have garnered a decent resale value, mm-hmm. and for some people, they just need the cash back. They just need the capital.
I see.
Like if you're right. downsizing and you amassed a great collection, but now you're no longer collecting and you have to move, then you might want to resell your collection or donate it to a museum or to a library or something.
Right. So as a grantee of the USA Assembly, you got a pretty nice grant. Do you mind mm-hmm. my asking how you plan on distributing that money?
I am going to buy myself a kiln.
Mm-hmm.
And pay a bunch of bills.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna I'm kind of a chipmunk, right? So I'm gonna hold some of it in my cheeks for a while before
right.
I spend it.
Because
I might need it if sales are not going well, then I might need to use it to pay rent, right?
Sure.
So I'm definitely not gonna go out and buy myself a new motorcycle.
Right. One thing that I definitely want to talk about is the category that you are in, or you were designated to as a grantee, is the craft category. There, for people listening, I mentioned this briefly when I mentioned the assembly that I attended along with you back in late March, that there grantees for across the art spectrum, pretty much. You know, everything from documentary filmmakers to experimental dramatists to musicians, et cetera, et cetera. And so you, as opposed to being in the fine art category, are in the craft category. And I just mm-hmm. wanted to see what you have to say about that, but even more poignantly, perhaps, ceramics' role in quote-unquote fine art. Its history and craft, but also it emerging, you know, in the last couple of decades more in contemporary art, and, you know, if even that those kinds of labels are even important to begin with.
Do you have a couple of years?
Go for it.
This is a much longer conversation.
Sure.
Because I straddle many worlds, but even in my own studio workspace.
Mm-hmm.
I make things that are sculpture,
mm-hmm.
and I make things that are utilitarian.
Mm-hmm.
The work I submitted to USA Artist was all sculptural-based work. But because of how they categorize, they do make a distinction, and I'm not sure how old the organization is, and if that's a holdover from you know, the early part of the 20th century's thinking that they just haven't gotten around to changing or dealing with. But it's a complicated question within the field of clay and ceramics and other kind of traditional craft-based work as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're making tapestries that are not like your granddad's tapestries, but you're using that technique to make the work, but it looks more like painting, then where are they going to put you? Is that a craft activity, or is that a fine art activity? So it's still complicated. Categorization is complicated, and pigeonholing.
Mm-hmm.
So because some things don't fit neatly into pigeonholes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and but just to play devil's advocate for just a second, the artists that you represent are majority artists working in ceramics. So, I mean, I could see people easily saying, Harvey Pressing Gallery, yeah, that's a ceramics gallery. You know, would that be okay with you?
That's fine. I don't particularly care how they classify it.
Mm-hmm.
I do care that they look at what they're looking at.
Yeah, sure. Get people to look rather than just what? Well, what's the alternative to looking?
Well, making an assumption
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of something that you haven't seen.
Right, right.
Right?
Right.
So
okay, yeah.
So if you see what we're talking about, and if you
mm-hmm.
know what we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
then we can have a conversation. But if you're like shooting from the hip and you honestly don't know what you're talking about, then there's no conversation to be had.
Right. Well, what I wanted to follow up on from just a few minutes ago, though, is you said when you described the sculpture that you submitted to USA Assembly, what does submitting entail? Because just for people listening, the way my understanding is that people anonymously or secretly nominate other people to be grantees, and that's what happened with you, correct?
Right, correct.
And what was the submission then? Yeah.
So you're nominated. You're nominated to apply.
Oh.
So you still have to go through an application process and submit images and papers and, you know, background information. You still have to apply, and it doesn't mean you're going to get it. Since I've received it, I've met people who've applied a couple of different times, and apparently you can only you're allowed to apply up to 3 times, and then you're not allowed to apply again. But you still have to go through the application process.
And did you know who recommended you?
No.
Okay.
And they don't tell you. They don't tell you who recommends you.
Right.
Although
there are exceptions.
Yes. Yeah.
There were some exceptions because I met a couple people there who had found out who recommended them.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I imagine that you're running the gallery and your road teaching and so on all helped your case as a grantee, right?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what their decision-making process looks like.
Okay.
And I also have sat on a number of committees for awarding grants and you know, putting shows together, and every group has a different set of criteria that they're looking for. So again, I don't know what their criteria was.
Right.
And that's another thing I really love doing is curating shows or being invited to talk to people about their work.
Mm-hmm. So I really want to dig back into your relationships, your dynamics with your collectors or with your clients, is maybe the word we used earlier. Because you certainly alluded to, I won't mention any names, you certainly alluded to being friends with a rather high-powered collector. But then in this conversation, you've kind of categorized being more, you know, I'm a very serious artist who runs a gallery where I take the artist seriously and I don't oversell by being a BS artist, you know, or being a salesperson. You know, I'm very honest about what I, you know, that I believe in these artists, but I don't have any guarantees about their work. And therefore, I'm going to cultivate collectors or clients who are, you know, equally invested and serious and not, you know, just people looking to buy baubles or what have you. You know, are there exceptions, you know, to that kind of model?
Not really. Not really, because you can't sell, I don't want to sell something that, whether it's an object or my program, that doesn't have bones.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And because you don't want to sell something to someone just for the sake of the sale,
mm-hmm.
and then they hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they hate you, and then they hate the artwork that they bought.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, I don't know why I bought this thing.
Right.
And it's like, the people who buy from my gallery, I want them to buy it because they've fallen in love with it.
Mm.
And my hope has always been that because of that interaction, I'm able to sell artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I'm presenting something that I'm hoping that they will believe in because I believe in it. And that's it. You know, and the things I love showing and talking about in the gallery, I feel have cultural significance, and they're part of a larger conversation about how we are as Americans, as a country, as a state, where things are currently in the world, and so. Yeah,
this is a gigantic question, and speaking of you know, how many hours or years do you have to talk about it, but I want to ask it anyway. How do you attach that kind of cultural importance to abstract, you know, pretty objects, if you don't mind that term?
Come on. Seriously. Things speak language. Whether it's the shoes you put on, mm-hmm. the shirt you select for the day, the mm-hmm. car you drive, mm-hmm. the objects you use in your home speak a language. Mm-hmm. What is that language, and what does it confer to you and the person, the people that are in your life?
Mm-hmm. Right.
They read and say a particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that thing mm-hmm. that you're saying about yourself, and where and what your politics are?
Interesting. Well, I think we would have to be witness to one of these conversations with your clients to really get more of a taste of what that actually is like.
Well, freaking come to Aspen.
I will.
Everybody, come on.
Yeah.
Come to Aspen.
We're
we'll
all
figure
putting it,
out. It
on our travel list, actually. So how many shows are you going to have? You just are about to open one. How many other shows are you going to have through the season, like that goes through September, early October?
Two more. Possibly three, mm-hmm. but definitely two.
Okay. And what is your social calendar going to look like over the next few months in terms of, like, how many nights a week are you going to be at, you know?
I'm
going
to go
parties.
To everything that I get invited to,
uh-huh.
and I'm going to work in my studio, mm-hmm. and I'm going to sell work, and it's going to be going. It's going to be rolling.
Are you going to be selling? Do you sell work out of your studio? Where do you sell your work?
My work, sometimes I sell work out of my studio. It's kind of part of the mix. I'll go to lots of lectures at the Anderson Ranch. I'll go to lectures at the Aspen Institute. I'll go to some music things, and I'm going to be involved.
Right, but you kind of trailed off from answering the question where you're going to be selling your work. I mean,
my work?
Yeah, your work.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. That's the part that's much more fungible.
Uh-huh. Right.
Like people pretty much have to know me to find out when the work is coming out.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how much of all the social activity do you enjoy all of it, or does some of it get to be a bit much?
Oh no, I enjoy all of it. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is we have choices, right? I don't go to parties where I don't go to events where it's all about the pose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to do that.
Right.
Right? And it exists in all of our lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're in LA, classic. Like, seen and be seen. I mean, how much of that work do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to go to those parties or those events.
Right. Right.
So, mm-hmm. you know, pick and choose.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm inquiring because as a gallerist, you know, who has shows going on during high season, you know, part of your job to a certain extent, right, is just being out there and being seen, not for the sake of being seen, but for making connections, right?
Yep. Well, that's the part I also love doing.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I love going to parties and seeing private collections and
mm-hmm.
Hanging out with my friends and meeting new friends and all of that stuff.
Okay.
But I have been to parties where I decided that I never have to come to these people's house again because there's more posturing than content, and
right.
that's not what I need.
Sure. Are you somewhere in the middle of the extrovert spectrum, or where would you place yourself there?
Both extremes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the reason I ask is because having hung out with you a bit, you know, in Chicago, it seemed like you reach a saturation point at a certain point.
Yes and no.
Mm.
Because once I reach saturation point, I go, okay, push it. Push it another half an hour.
Oh.
Push another hour.
Uh-huh.
Let's see where you start to get weak, or where you start to, like, really lose it.
Uh-huh.
But then there are times when I'll be at my house and I won't answer the phone or talk to someone for a couple of days
because
part of me is also a hermit.
Right.
And I don't want to hear you freaking breathing.
Nice. Wow. I don't know if there's a better moment to end on, but I do at least want to ask you if you feel like there's anything that you want to talk about that we haven't covered yet, because it hasn't been a super long conversation. I feel like, you know, I'm sure we could find other things, but is there anything that's really coming strongly to the surface for you that we didn't get to?
Nope.
Okay.
I feel lucky. I feel completely blessed. I'm glad I met you at USA Artists.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. That organization deserves huge kudos and much more attention for the work it does.
Right.
I feel really lucky. I mean, I grew up in New Orleans, and I decided early on that I was going to leave my little bubble of New Orleans and see what the world had to offer.
Mm-hmm.
But that also was not easy, right? It's like to leave the culture and the people you know and take the risk of like going someplace where you don't know anybody.
Yeah.
So it's just like gird your loins and jump in.
So just to clarify about the invitation to come visit you, are we talking about, you know, coming to visit your studio but not necessarily staying at your place, I would imagine, right?
Well, we could pitch a tent, and it's 10 acres. You can pitch a tent.
That's a
you
good
You can
point.
Sleep
right.
on a couch. You can...
Okay.
I could put you up with some friends.
Wow.
Everything for me is like figuring out how we're going to make it work.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's like that guy, Tim, what's his name, on that show about... clothes.
Which one?
Tim Gunn.
Oh, right, right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Isn't his catchphrase "make it work"?
Yeah, it's something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to figure out how to make it work.
Right.
There are no easy pat answers, and it may not work, but we're going to definitely give it a try.
It was great to talk to you, Sam, as I hoped it would
All
be.
Right.
It was.
Let's do some more.
Definitely part two at some point.
All right, enjoy the rest of your day, and if anyone in the audience wants to contact me, please do so.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much again to Sam. I would really be curious to know if any of you guys do go visit him in Aspen. I would like to go even as soon as this summer, but, you know, still got to get there. So maybe in the fall, perhaps the winter even. But do let me know if any of you guys head out there. I'd be really curious to hear what that encounter, what that visit is like. So we do have, as I said, some great old news to catch you up on, several different varying styles of pieces. First, I wanted to thank recent and ongoing supporters of the show, in particular, the Patreon monthly leaders, Carl E. Smith, Karen Lynn Baumgartner, and Stephanie Kogler-Heimberger, who are all supporting the show with a $10 a month donation. Big thanks to producers Andy Davis, Sarah Suarez, Stephanie Kogler-Heimberger, and Megan Bickle for their critical contributions. And before I finally jump into the old news, want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. I really, really, really do live on the occasional donations that I received. I just received one from Alaska, which I was really excited about. And, you know, you can do it one of a few ways. You can just do the good old-fashioned PayPal. You can do Patreon, which is a way that you can support the show on an ongoing basis for as little as $1 a month. The more that you can contribute, and that goes for PayPal as well, the more bonuses you can get. We're up to 9 or 10 now, I believe. And as I had mentioned last episode, I'm still working on the Max Haven bonus where he talks about his upcoming project about revenge. It's a book he's researching next. So that will be together soon, and that will be sent out to all of the supporters. If you can support the show for $35 or more, one-time donation, you will get all the bonus episodes available. Plus, I can get you a bumper sticker, P-word, or conversation logo bumper sticker, and your undying love, and anything else that I might be able to provide for you. You can also support the show via Venmo or good old-fashioned check, which people have indeed taken advantage of. And thanks to all of you who have and are supporting the show. Once again, you can support the show non-financially by leaving a great review on our Apple Podcast page, also Stitcher, Google Play, iHeart Podcasts, and more. I believe we are on as well. You can follow the show at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. I'm not tweeting, but we appreciate the occasional mention. So, and do check out our Instagram feed, though, if you haven't already. All right, so old news, starting with podcast alum and regular appearer in the old news, Tim Schneider. And this is from ArtNet, and it's called Burn It Down, and it's right out of Max Haven's book. Not literally, but the same exact type of work that he covered. In the New York Times this Wednesday, Josie Thaddeus-Johns wrote about the quietly revolutionary, in the political sense, P-word of London-based artists Daniel Edelston and Hilary Powell. And while the duo's concerns radiate beyond the narrow boundaries of the art world, their work nevertheless got me thinking about just how thoroughly the art market has come to model itself on some of the more unequal aspects of the financial markets. The idea central to Bank Job, Edelston and Powell's latest project, is debt. Since 2017, they have been printing and selling artworks in the form of an alternative currency out of a former bank in London's Walthamstow suburb. The effort is both a protest of predatory lending and a means of combating it. The duo splits the sales proceeds, donating half to a quartet of local nonprofits and using the rest to buy bundles of payday loan debts resold by banks at a deep discount below their face value. Normally, the only entities buying these kinds of debts are collections agencies, which then profit on the trade by relentlessly hounding the individual debtors to try to extract more cash than the agency paid. Many, if not most, people who default on loans do so out of genuine hardship, often because of matters outside their control, rather than a conscious desire to give the man the middle finger. So the collectors generally only manage to worsen the average debtor's already humiliating and desperate state of existence. But Edelston and Powell do something different with their newly acquired debts. Void them. Although this outcome has a limited, at best, effect on the debtor's actual financial circumstances, by the time your debt gets flipped on the resale market, your credit history is pretty much a raging inferno. It makes visible a world financial system that is, in key respects, designed to entrap the many for the benefit of the few. To date, the artists have purchased and forgiven about £1.2 million, that's $1.5 million, worth of payday loan debt. Aside from the social P-word element of the project, Bank Job will also live on as a forthcoming feature-length documentary by Edelston and Powell. And the connection they've established between the art market and the debt market reminds me of the various ways the former has adopted the latter, for better and worse. Again, that's ArtNet, Tim Schneider. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, Charles Desmarais, and his name came up in last episode with Rennie Pritikin of Bay Area legendary fame. And this Charles Desmarais SF Chronicle article is titled, Why is African American Art Having a Moment? The reasons are as varied as the art itself. Now, this is a long article. I'm not reading the whole thing. I'm just reading an excerpt that Megan Bickle directed my attention to. So Pamela Joyner, who is a trustee and a member of influential committees at the Art Institute of Chicago, J. Paul Getty Trust, Tate America's Foundation, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Quote, my only real role in a boardroom is to ask, have you considered? She makes clear her respect for curators' training and experience. Yet, once they, quote, see the full range of what there is, that personal history, that narrative within the context of the full arc of art history, they come back to me and say, it's important, and here's why it's important. That's just that part of the ecosystem doing what it is charged with doing, which is to create new knowledge. People are open to doing what they have been trained to do, but to tell a comprehensive story, she said, that's what's changed. And all of that is contextual to lead up to this part of the article. Karen Jenkins Johnson, an art dealer who is African-American, talked about that new attitude in an interview at her eponymous gallery near Union Square in San Francisco. Quote, when I first started in 1996, I had maybe two artists of color, she said. I have to say that people in the mainstream would not collect artists of color. And if I wanted to have a business, I had to have artwork that I could sell. I was not a nonprofit, unquote. She dates the change in perspective to a specific year, 2008. Quote, there was a huge sea change in the art world in general, which was, of course, stimulated by the election of Barack Obama, she said. I think the mainstream art world realized that they were exposed. They did not have artists that looked like the president in their institutions. A lot of periodicals didn't have writers who knew how to have dialogues with people of color. Okay, so that's, again, from Charles Desmarais' Why is African American Art Having a Moment? The reasons are as varied as the art itself. And again, from the SF Chronicle. This is from the art newspaper. Are we worried enough about the planet to give up jet setting to art fairs? And this goes back to a couple of, if not a few, conversations I've had with guests who do a lot of traveling, just to give you a little context. It's very difficult to do my job without flying. So said the British actress Emma Thompson in April when she was criticized for flying 5,400 miles back from Los Angeles to London to support the Extinction Rebellion protest against climate change. For me, Thompson's words struck a nerve, as I imagine they did with many who work in this global art market. The mind boggles to think how many flights were taken last month in order to worthily stroke chins in front of the many climate change-themed works at the opening of the Venice Biennale, or indeed will be taken this week to do much the same at Art Basel. There is an inescapable hypocrisy in our actions. Full disclosure, I'm as guilty as anyone and in no position to preach. Last year, I took 18 flights for my job, which is a lot by many people's standards, but is considered a paltry number in the art world. And, of course, I've flown to Basel to produce a print publication. But are there some flights I've taken unnecessarily? Honestly, yes. Thompson's actions beg the question, could we do our jobs without taking umpteen flights a year? If a salesperson at a blue-chip gallery refused to fly to yet another art fair on ethical grounds, would they risk losing their job or stunting their career as another more willing replacement is found? Probably, but such a protest is not, in this age, unreasonable. For the art world to help curb climate change on a practical level and not simply pay lip service to the idea, we should be more accountable for our actions, and the biggest thing we could do as individuals is cut down on the number of flights we take. As the scientist, environmentalist, and broadcaster David Suzuki says, our personal consumer choices have ecological, social, and spiritual consequences. It is time to re-examine some of our deeply held notions that underlie our lifestyles. What would a truly environmentally friendly art world look like? Probably a far more provincial one in which we do not buy anything new and instead collect old master paintings and antique furniture from our local salesroom or dealer, transported home strapped to the top of a Tesla. Fares would be local, reachable by electric car or train, and client pools would necessarily shrink. Or perhaps technology would allow us to just buy virtually through initiatives such as Gagosian's online viewing room, although the electricity requirement of the digital realm comes with its own massive carbon footprint. In many ways, the art world is in a better position now than ever to conduct its business without the need to travel. And yet, human relationships would be shrunk right down again to email, phone, or Skype exchanges. There is a reason why virtual fairs have struggled. They fail to reproduce the social function such events play. The question is, are we sufficiently worried about our impact on the planet to give up that freedom, privilege, and progress to which we are so accustomed and return to a life much more provincial? We should be. The art market is not going to be deglobalized, nor should it be. But we really should be more selective and think about whether our presence, or indeed, that work of art, is really needed on the other side of the world. Otherwise, our current interest in climate change will prove to be little more than an on-message theme for topical but vacuous exhibitions. That's from Anna Brady. Interesting. I would like to talk to you more about that, Anna, for the record. And finally, from a local source, going to the local appropriately enough, this is the LA Times. It's Gustavo Arellano, and his piece is, it's an article called LA Trucker Turns Road Grime and Elbow Grease into Mobile Masterpieces. One day in 2016, as Arnulfo Gonzalez waited at a warehouse to pick up cargo, he stared at the filth caked on the back door of his box truck. After a moment of contemplation, he ran his finger on it. The Mexican immigrant once had ambitions to become an artist. He had earned a degree in the subject from East Los Angeles College and taught ceramics workshops in Bell Gardens. He took his wife on date nights to drawing classes, where they used each other as subjects. Gonzalez set aside those dreams and became a trucker in 2000, quote, because there was more money there, the father of two said. Besides an occasional notebook doodle, work and his family were his focus, until the day he realized that his canvas and paint had been there all along. It clicked, Gonzalez said. By the time his load was ready, he had outlined a woman's face in the muck. Often the 48-year-old Gonzalez answers his muse as he waits for cargo to get loaded. He likes to use classical music as a soundtrack, Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata as a favorite. Truckers long have personalized their rigs. In Pakistan and India, so-called jingle trucks feature calligraphy, beads, extravagantly colored arabesque designs, or Hindu motifs. Japan's Decotora subculture celebrates trucks with ironworks and light seemingly pulled from an anime. In Spain, artists convince truckers to let them paint contemporary works on containers as a way to protest the strictures of museums. American truck art, on the other hand, historically has been staid. Mud flap silhouettes, the trucker's name stenciled on the side doors, or, in recent years, toys tied to grills or hung on the back bumper or axle. Lavishly adorned commercial trucks, quote, are not part of our culture, unquote, said Max Heine, editorial director for Overdrive. Every year, the magazine hosts Pride and Polish, which it describes as the, quote, premier truck beauty championship series in North America, unquote. Heine said American trucker aesthetics tend to focus more on chrome parts, paint jobs meant to evoke classic Peterbilts and Kenworths, or a beat-up rusted look known as rat rod. By those standards, Gonzalez's truck is humble. Again, that is from the LA Times, and I'm particularly intrigued by this because I like the idea of art that you can see as you are driving on the freeway. And I will look out for that truck. So that is all for this episode. I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation, got something out of the old news, and I appreciate your support in advance. Thank you so much for listening. Do let me know if you go visit Sam in Aspen. And in the meantime, I will talk to you soon. Ciao for now.